Welcome to Open Comments with me, Ash.
And me, Oliver.
Where we'll discuss things openly with our guests from a variety of backgrounds and from different walks of life. Through this podcast, we hope to give you an inside look into a variety of topics with an equal mix of humour and candour. In this series so far, we have covered healthcare, HR, diversity, access to technology. In this episode, we'll be talking to Paul Smith, entrepreneur, mentor, and writer. We hope you enjoy our show and look forward to bringing more topics into the fold. Let's get started.
Thank you, Ash. So, as you mentioned, today we have Paul Smith. So, Paul is an experienced and successful business builder with ownership, leadership, and management interests in a variety of businesses. Some of Paul's specialities include startups, mentoring entrepreneurs, business planning, business development, business grooming, and ownership exit. So, Paul, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Great to be here.
I'm just wondering if you could provide for us just a brief overview of your career so far, you know, where you are now.
Gosh, yes. Well, we go back to when I left school, I was the drummer in a rock band, and that was all that was important to me. And I thought that was going to be my life. That balloon very quickly burst, I can tell you. I qualified as a chartered surveyor in the early 1980s as my attempt to rescue my life from what I then saw as the dregs of a rock and roll lifestyle. Built up a small practice in my own name between sort of 84 and 90, and then was approached by somebody who saw what I was doing, who made me an offer for my company. And that I can't tell you that I was particularly enjoying being a chartered surveyor, but I was making a living out of it. So once, when this opportunity arose to sell the company, I realized that what I'd done was to start, build, and then was able to sell a micro company. There was only 8 or 10 of us in there at the time. And that led me to think that my career should be about starting, building, and selling small businesses, and I should be agnostic to the industries in which I work. And that's what I was then able to do over the following 25, 30 years or so. In the mid-2000s, I had worked on the creation of a small company that was working adjunct of the health service here in the UK around some changes that were being made to how hospitals were being run. And I set that company up with a view to it being disruptive within an industry where there were only one or two very large players, with the ambition that at the appropriate time, if I was successful, either of those companies would want to buy that business from me. And that's indeed what happened. So in 2008, I made that sale. And that gave me the opportunity to sit back and reappraise again what I wanted to do at that stage. I designed and built my own house for a couple of 3 years, went to live in America and lived a hedonistic lifestyle for a couple of 3 years, reviewed where I was, came back to the UK and decided that some aspect of giving back was what I wanted to do. So mentoring became important to me, and I started to work with young entrepreneurs at various different stages in their entrepreneurial journey, whether they were dreamers, they had a defined ambition, or they were ready to execute upon their plan. Started to think more about my own experience and how I could bring that to bear to help others out as well. Made some investments in some small companies myself, and now work as a mentor to the managing directors of 2 or 3 different companies that I have an ownership interest in. And generally more time to now work on everything that's considered to be work and business, rather than up until that point where I had been working in those organizations more so. So that's kind of me and my journey so far.
And touching on mentoring, can you explain why you're so passionate about it? And as you said, the notion of giving back and exploring it in more detail.
Sure. When I was embarking upon my career, nothing was for free. If you wanted advice, you would go to your accountant or your solicitor and they'd turn the meter on. They wouldn't hesitate to charge you the full rates, and you would very quickly burn through your cash, or more readily, you wouldn't seek that advice because you didn't have the money and the wherewithal to pay for the information you wanted to. So I think that there's a part of me feels the need to provide a mentoring service entirely without charge and entirely without any ties or expectations on my part. I'm happy to work with people and comment on their business plan. That they never get, if you're a Dragon's Den fan, we've grown up now in the last 10, 15 years with this idea that if you don't like a business plan, you say you're out. And I can't think of anything worse for the young entrepreneur and their motivation than somebody just being so blunt and direct with them. So everybody would get something out of the time I'll spend with them, whether that's just simply helping them to realize, not right now, not quite that way, business plan needs this degree of work, that degree of work, or help get that business plan into shape, and it is investable by me, it's not, and I'll push it off to somebody else. Everybody gets something. There's never this concept that giving back through mentoring, it has a bluntness to it. It's always trying to find something. And when I'm doing that, I'm remembering the lack of access I had when I was a youngster working in my first business to try and solve some of those issues. A lot of that's quite focused on the business fundamentals as well. It's not like we're trying to deal with very complex problems within businesses. Most startups, and especially the first startup for most entrepreneurs, have just got the basic building blocks of business about them. And if they can get those right, there's no reason why whatever their ambition and their idea is, if we've got that foundation of blocks in place, then they're ready to go and see what they can do at the top. I think another rationale for me giving back is that during my career, it's fair to say there was some blood spilled. There were some noses put out of joint. It's inevitable. Things like when you sell a small business, particularly in my experience, typically the staff won't know until the deal is done. And there's this quite imposing morning when you're going to call a staff meeting that nobody's expecting, and you're going to introduce the new owner, and you're just going to wave goodbye and walk out the door. And I know that has left a number of people feeling less than satisfied by their time working with me. I can't go back and change any of that, but what I can do is adjust how I use my time going forward to try and, I wouldn't say make recompense, because those costs are generally the types of costs one would incur in doing what I've done to start, build and sell small businesses. But I feel that there is some degree of balance that comes from me putting my time and effort into helping people going forwards that balances with whatever has been left in the wake of my working career.
The way that you're giving back is also inspiring and encouraging new entrepreneurs, and maybe they'll do the same later on in life as well, so it could hopefully go for the same.
I'd like to think so. I'd certainly think that I see a very different approach to entrepreneurialism in your age group, you guys' age group, rather than mine. Where there is a great sense of, you know, of how you fit into the world, more so than perhaps, you know, in the 80s when I was getting my feet wet and all this sort of dipping my beak first time round. It was, you know, there was this thrusting world in which, you know, we were seeing people on the TV being hugely successful, you know, big shoulder suits and all that kind of stuff. You know, it was power dressing, it was power this and power that, and you got carried along with that. I think today there is a more humane approach to business and less of a desire to consume in the process of building businesses, and more a desire to have valuable impact on things, real outcomes that affect people or business or society or the planet or whatever it might be. I think that is a start point for young entrepreneurs here in the 21st century. Does, as you say, Oliver, give a great chance for them to become people who themselves will see the need to give back and repay in the future somewhere.
Yeah.
Thank you. Now, what advice could you give to recent graduates who may feel a little stuck or unsure with what they want to do? Following question to this, has there been any advice from your mentors that has stayed with you? And please feel free to spill out that question, because it is a long one.
I think in terms of a recent graduate who is stuck, I would think the idea for them is to first of all ask, is there really a problem in that? Is that a difficulty? You know, society perhaps is the framework of reference that that person or we will look at that and say, well, no, you've got to have a true direction in life. Well, gosh, don't you know what you're going to do? Haven't you, you know, get a job, get a career? That's just a societal framework of reference, which is perhaps unhelpful in this day and age again. So I would first of all challenge that individual if they were in front of me to say, do you really have a problem? Actually, is not this sense of being stuck actually a sense of great opportunity? And what you're stuck with is not knowing which of the great opportunities that sit before you should take, rather than thinking there's nothing I can do anymore and it's a barrier in front of me. So I think that that's a very important part. And people need to stay flexible when they get to that stage. I think this is true all the way through careers, rather than just when you're trying to find what your direction of travel is going to be. You know, at a practical level, if this is a graduate that we're talking about who finds himself in this position, certainly keep your overheads low. You know, don't sign a lease for a year on a flat, or, you know, and buy a new car or anything like that. Keep your overheads low so you are flexible yourself, and therefore you can experiment with things. You can take time to think. You can dip your toe here, have a go at that, spend a few months doing this. Stay flexible. But as I say, I think that's something that we should be doing throughout our careers anyway. Curiosity is perhaps a key thing that they need to harness at this stage. They need to be questioning everything around them. Get out and travel a little bit. Talk to people, meet people, ask why. You know, we lose the ability to ask why regularly at about the age of 7 or 8. You know, between the ages of 3 and 4 and maybe 8 and 9, perhaps, everything starts with why. And then life starts to overcome us and we lose this ability to continually be curious. I think if you find yourself stuck and you're still in your early 20s, that's a great chance to re-embrace the word why and challenge everything that you see around you and see what that brings in terms of ideas that can give you a path to follow. But I think the key thing is to accept that we don't have jobs for life anymore. When I started out, there were jobs for life. There were still bank managers who'd been a bank manager since they left school, when they were a bank manager when they retired, and they didn't travel out of the town they lived in. They'd be the captain of their golf club. They'd be the president of their Rotary club. They'd be this and that and the other. And that was a defined job for life with all the boxes along the way that one has to tick to get to the end of a satisfactory career. The gig economy, the idea of wider experiences, I think, have all done for the job for life. And so, again, I think that's perhaps a thing which that young graduate who feels stuck should eschew. Just throw that out the back door. I don't need a job for life. I don't need a career. I just need something that's going to be entertaining, earn me enough money to live the life that I want to live.
And don't be afraid to, as you say, get your feet wet in various areas.
Yeah.
Try different things out, because I guess a lot of people now follow the route from university of, this is what my degree is and this is what I need to go into, but you don't necessarily have to do that.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And it's also perhaps a timely reminder that in this day and age, I think we need to be ready in our minds to accept and embrace failure as a point on the path to success. Whereas, again, maybe the societal framework within which we're brought up, we're thought to exist, eschews failure. We don't want that. You know, we want to make sure that everything we do is successful. But actually, you know, failure is a key part of the learning program. This is where I see great difference between British and American entrepreneurs. I've had the chance to work with both, and American entrepreneurs are so much more open and committed and risk-taking. And because failure is not failure in the sense that you failed. Failure is an opportunity to learn and recalibrate and reshape your ideas and get it better next time and so on and so forth. Whereas the conservative British attitude to failure is, oh dear, I failed. And you know, that has a negative effect upon ambition, and the desire to get back up off your knees and have another go.
So, and in terms of maybe how people are seen as well, so for example, if someone, you know, goes for a job interview and they prep for like months and they're very motivated and they're like, this is going to be the one, and it might not work out for them at that time, they might not be part of their plan or something, but it's like, although you can learn a lot from that process and they may take a lot from it, their initial thought might be after that, like, oh, I failed, what's going to happen now? I'm now going to not have a job and all that. And it's like, it's one of those things where it's almost like they're conditioned to be in that mindset of, it's now not going to work for me going forward, as opposed to saying, right, it didn't work out for me, let me recalibrate, let me just settle, think to myself, and actually, you know, if I'm going down a different pathway, that's okay. If it takes a bit of time, that's okay. But it's almost like not putting that pressure of, I failed once, I'm going to keep on failing because this experience didn't work out how I thought it would work out. Mm. That preconceived notion. Mm-hmm. I think it's so important that, you know, you can learn, not only you can learn a lot from failure, but it shouldn't be a thing where it's almost like you're labeled as a failure because, you know, you prepped so hard for this job interview and you didn't get it, so that's down to you.
Mm.
But really, the reality could be it just wasn't your timing. Mm. And that's okay. You know, it's not a bad thing.
Mm. Yeah. No, I couldn't agree more. It's not about the individual. That's also an important aspect. You know, what you just said is absolutely true, Ash, but you use the term the individual, the person. And one of the ways in which we can much better embrace failure is to be dispassionate to the thing that failed. You know, there's an old saying that I was brought up with, and that is, it's just business. You know, and that's when you're having to be tough with people, when you're having to create conflict or be controversial or you know, whatever the situation might be. You know, we always used to just sort of say, well, look, it's just business. And what we were trying to say at that stage was, you know, we as individuals are bigger than the business kind of thing. It's just over there. And it's something that today is our issue. Nobody's changing your life forever. Nobody's undermining your health. You know, it's just business. So I do think that being dispassionate to the thing that's failing is a big step forward that the young entrepreneur can make from embracing failure as their own personal failure. Very hard to do. Probably comes with experience more so than being something you can be taught. But it's one of those cathartic moments when you suddenly realize that it was the business that failed. I did everything that I could. Next time I'm going to do what I do differently, but I didn't fail. This puts us right back on the forward foot, thrusting forwards to have another go.
You talked about not necessarily being passionate about something that failed, but flipping that on its head. And in your experience, maybe, are you still passionate about your successful businesses, or have you managed to separate yourself from them so you can still think of them as separate moving forwards?
Yes, very much so. I try and maintain a separation. In the businesses that I have ownership interests at the moment, I only work with the managing director or the general manager in each individual situation to just help them fulfill their potential, and as they fulfill their potential, the business will fulfill its potential as well. So to that end, I maintain a dispassionate relationship with the business as it is. One or two of them do some really great stuff, and I see customers and partners of those businesses getting a lot out of being a customer or a partner for that business. And, you know, you can't help but be impressed by that, you know, tugs a little string inside. We are, at the end of the day, human. But as far as the day-to-day work that I would do, it's all about working on those businesses rather than working in those businesses. And therefore, working on the business, it's no different to me pushing my coffee cup around the table or taking the cap on and off my pen, as you are observing me doing all the time. You know, those are things that I'm not passionate about. So I just do those. And that's what I feel about business. You just get on and do it rather than get too passionately associated with it.
Is there a particular business that you do have of yours that you do have maybe just a few extra heartstrings for?
Yes, I suppose there is. I have ownership interests in a small chain of day nurseries here in the UK, based around central southern England. And there I see people who work in our company who are driven entirely by their passion for childcare. Frankly, it's an industry in which one's unable to make any kind of significant pay awards to staff. We're controlled so much by government funding. Many of our staff are on minimum wage. Yet they are so passionate about what they do, go the extra mile every day, put up with so much for the level of reward that the business can afford to give them. And that rubs off on you. You know, I visit these nurseries and I'm looking at how can we get more children in? How can we do more with less? How can we bring forward cash? How can we, you know, more solidify the team? What can I do to the premises to give us more space or take away problems, all those kind of strategic things. But then you just sit and watch a practitioner sat with a group of children playing with them, and you look at the reaction, but what both the adult and the children are getting out of it. You do, that starts to pull on the heartstrings, and you feel, I'd love to be able to make us do more of that. And you know, so that's one where it's very difficult to define that line solidly.
You've mentioned a little bit in the day-to-day, it's working on the businesses, not within the businesses. Where do you fit your mentoring for these aspiring entrepreneurs in a day? Is that just as and when you see them? Or?
It is, yes, and it's not every day. I mean, I might speak to somebody new once a month, maybe 10 times a year. So it's not that great a time constraint. In the past, 5-6 years ago, I was looking at a lot more business plans, meeting with a lot more people then. But I've slowed it down a little bit now, and it's as and when required, really. Quite often, I find the first points of contact with a young entrepreneur are fairly standard. It's the usual things that one's got to look at. That is, how well are they articulating what they're going to do within their business plan? That's fairly easy to deal with. Because as I said before, I tend to not concentrate on the uniqueness of their idea. I think my role is to bring them back to business fundamentals and get some building blocks in place and get them moving in the right direction so the foundations are there for them to be able to do whatever the magic is that their business plan is bringing forward. So because there's quite a lot of repetition in what I find the young entrepreneur needs at their differing stages, it's quite easy to just click in. I don't have to sit and think for a long time, how best can I help this person? It's usually quite obvious what they need. And the other thing that one can't do in doing what I do is overflow them with information, overload them with information. Otherwise, they just can't cope with it. So it's, you know, just feed a little bit in here, go away and have a think about this little piece here, and then come back and then we'll do this little bit here. Sometimes the entrepreneurs are not able to operate at a slowed down pace and want to run at 100 miles an hour straight at their business opportunity. That may or may not dictate how well I can help them. But I find, therefore, it's slipping bits of time in here and there because a lot of it's quite similar from one entrepreneur to another that I would help. I can't think that I've ever had a mentor in the way that I try and mentor young entrepreneurs. Again, back in the 80s when I was starting off, it wasn't so much that there were people who were mentors in that regard. I think, although the term has become corrupt in the 21st century, I think there were people in my day who were influencers. And I don't mean that, you know what I mean by corrupt.
Not like TikTok.
Yeah, quite, not like TikTok, no. There were TV programs that started to give you thoughts and ideas. There was one called Troubleshooter that was by John Harvey Jones. This was in the very early 90s. He was an ex-chairman of ICI, and he defined the business analysis program. You know, these days we have things like Dragon's Den, The Apprentice, Mary Portas's Queen of Shops, Alex Polizzi does The Hotel Inspector. All of these business problem-solving programs, I think, take their roots back to John Harvey Jones's Troubleshooter. And that was quite a big influence on me, that there was a different way of doing business. That probably, through watching him analyze the problems within businesses, both some well-known, some not, And then imposing his suggestions on how they solve their problems was my first exposure to working on a business as opposed to working in a business. It was a real kind of light bulb moment for me. Travel programs were quite influential. There was a couple of the names you probably won't know, but Alan Wicker was one of the guys who, Wicker's World, those fabulous travel logs that he would put together and exposés of different parts of the world and reasons why you should consider going there. And that always helped me to get my nose out off my desk and out of my office and out of home and think about how small a part I'm playing in a much bigger world. And that always, I always felt that was an influence on me, to never think that there are any constraints imposed upon me, that the world is one's oyster, shall we say.
Would you also say as well, in terms of, you know, like those type of programs where it says reasons you should do this or visit this place, that going back to curiosity kind of ignited something where you're like, actually, yeah, I want to try that out, or I want to discover that. It might not have been in that moment, you know, for certain reasons, but later on, but kind of like planted that seed as such to go, yeah, I want to see what that place is like, or, you know, if it lives up to expectation, or even if it's even better than they say it is, because that happens sometimes, that kind of, you know, prolonging that curiosity as such.
Yeah, and I think that's true. And I think that's also the travel, the travel analogy, as you just described it, is a good metaphor for continuing to learn and continuing to develop, which I think we're all obliged to do. With the moment you stop thinking that I don't need to continuously develop and learn in my life, I think you're done, you're finished. It's so important to making sure that there's new opportunities, that you're fulfilling your potential within your own life journey and your own lifespan. So that idea of wanting to go and check it out for yourself and learn more than you learned in the first touch point that, in my world, the program gave me, is, as I say, a metaphor for continuous lifelong learning, I would say.
I think also, not to sound too cheesy with this, but in terms of, you know, with, like, say, if someone's got, or if you have your own toolkit, you know, you'd always sharpen those tools, make sure they're clean and, you know, up to standard. So why wouldn't you want to do that for yourself in terms of your skill sets or just in general? Because otherwise it's like, you know, things, like, I don't like to say rusty, but it's like, in terms of your knowledge, it could change and develop over time. But if you're not maybe keeping yourself as updated as possible, you might, I don't mind saying left behind, but in a way, your knowledge may not be so up to date. So by refreshing every now and then, you're kind of not only making yourself more aware of the different trends and, you know, tools out there, but you're just, yeah, sharpening your skills and improving yourself. And I think improving as well is, that's never too late to do that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, there's I've often thought about lifelong learning as doing two things for me. One is when I learn something new, whether that's informally, just through experience, observation, you know, keeping one's chin up, one's eyes open, one's ears open, vital throughout life, business, personal, everything. You've got to observe, not just see. Is it Conan Doyle wrote in Sherlock Holmes, didn't he? Sherlock talking to Watson, Watson, you see, but you do not observe, as being a critical, a critique of why Watson can't see what Sherlock can around the problems of some crime or whatever. I think that's a truism for life. Observe, don't just see. And that gives you that informal learning. And then, you know, you can apply structured learning on top of that as well. So the one thing you get is new learning. But I think every time you learn something new, certainly inside me, it recalibrates everything else I know. So it's not just that I layer something on top of everything else I know. Suddenly I've got something filtering all the way down through everything else I know, and my paradigms might shift here and there, my perceptions might change, my understanding of something might change. A whole bunch of new why questions arise. And so we're off on further learning and discovery and curiosity driving that whole process.
In a way, I guess it's like recharging, isn't it? You're getting a new, like, just a burst of, you know, something, and that helps improve things.
Yeah. There might be a situation in which you have too many things that then go through your mind, and that, I think, might be back to where we were with our stuck graduate a little while ago. Just stop. Is it a problem? Yes. Find something to deflect your thought process. Be distracted. Try new things. All those things which get you back to a reality again. Just coming back to mentors that you asked me about, and I was talking about influencers, a couple of other things that I just wanted to put on the table here as well. There's, you mentioned about sharpening tools, Ash. So that reminds me of an author and speaker called Stephen Covey, who wrote a book called The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. Iconic text from, must be 30 years old now, if not a bit longer. And the Covey Institute, I believe it's called, has gone on to do some great work with executives around the world and helping people to just find themselves in a difficult environment. And his, out of his 7 habits, the ones that I really embraced and that were, have been a strong influence for me over my career, because I read that book just after it came out, first of all, and I've probably read it at least every couple of years since, and I've always got it near to hand to dive in and out of. But his approach to time management, it has been a great influence on me. His approach to time management is to not think about a long to-do list and what's the next thing I've got to do. He recommends that you manage your time based upon your roles. So you chunk your time out on roles. So I have a role as a father, husband, grandfather, a business owner, mentor, writer, all the things I do, gardener, everything else that I enjoy doing. And so I plan my week on the basis of how much time should I be allocating to each of the roles I perform. And then when I come to a time of the week which says, now I'm going to be working on this business, then I'll worry about what other things I've got to do in that business. And I'll start with the most important item on that list. And now I get my time spread equally over all the things that I've chosen to be involved in, rather than constantly chasing my tail to say, geez, I haven't touched that for 2 weeks. I need to spend some time on that. And it suddenly becomes urgent rather than where it should have just been important. And urgent important is another aspect of Covey's approach to time management and establishing what your priorities are. But this approach to chunking your time based upon your roles, rather than just sitting under the oppression of an ever-growing to-do list and a full diary of appointments.
At least in that case as well, it's almost, I guess it's filtering the sense that, say, if you were to have like a long to-do list, it's probably ever-growing. It's very overwhelming looking at it anyway. Whereas if you're filtering in those different categories, it's like, right, dealing with this, dealing with that, and it feels less overwhelming. And also you feel like it's like a more of a tick job as opposed to looking at a whole list and going, yeah, but where do I start?
Yeah.
That's the whole
thing. It would be a chance to, one of your things you enjoy doing, you mentioned, was gardening. So I'm assuming that whilst you're gardening, you're not thinking about what you have to do for your business.
No,
in certain situations. I'm
thinking about the gardening.
Yeah, so that's, it's a absolutely great way of,
yeah,
almost disassociating from whatever stress or workload you may have. And it's, you focus on you there and then,
yes,
and then you deal with it when you come
to, and being more present as well in the moment.
That's right, yeah, and spreading yourself equally over all the things that you deem to be important in your life, and not letting any of those, you know, if you deem something important, it requires your time to do it. You know, if that's reading, you know, then allocate time to read and decide what you're going to read when you come to the time you've allocated. Not say, geez, I've got to finish that book this week. Because now you've shifted it again from this proactive, gentle approach to making sure my time is equally used into suddenly this artificial pressure that you've got on you.
Dreading that you have to get it done.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so that's very important. I recommend Stephen Covey's approach to time management to everybody. The other one that I wanted to mention was Stoicism. So this is the Greek and Roman philosophical approach to life, which is kind of all about tranquility in your mind and, you know, making sure that you're morally the best person that you can be. And there's two or three things that I've taken from Stoicism, which again I harness on a day-to-day basis. One is understanding that the only thing we control is our feelings, our emotions, and how we react to what happens. We can't control what happens. You know, it's immediately in the past. Our chance for wisdom is to carefully consider what our reaction to what happens is. And I think if people get to a point where they do it, just they never get emotionally entangled in something that happened. Sure, we can feel bad and feel sad about things and be surprised and shocked by things. But let that emotion pass quickly and get oneself into the proactive space again of what is my best reaction to that. I think that's so important, and it's very difficult to do in the majority of cases. But when you get to that state of mind, I think you do then have an opportunity to be the wisest person you can be in how you react. The other thing that I've got from the Stoics over the years is what they call negative visualization, which we might refer to these days as hope for the best and plan for the worst. But it's about imagining each thing that you want to do, each thing you're going to try and influence to happen, and your reactions to things. Imagining what's the worst thing that could happen, what could go wrong, and planning to minimize the things that can go wrong. And a lot of people will think that that's a negative approach and we should be on the forward foot a bit more and be proactive against those things. But I feel that it's right to do that, because what you want to do is you want to make sure you've got the greatest chance of success. And the greatest chance of success is about minimizing the chances of failure. So we have to address risk management in that way. So negative visualization, something very important. So yeah, those so Stephen Covey's time management, the Stoicism around control and negative visualization, those TV programs, that's all the things that have kind of influenced me over the years.
These are all things, especially the Stoicism, in my opinion, is for the individual. So you can't control what other people are going to, or how other people are going to react, or how they feel. It's all about yourself, and it's a way of separating, you know, your feelings to your team or other people.
So. Yes, and if you're going to assume this responsibility to be the morally the best person you can be, to be the most virtuous person you can be, then it is all about you. It is about how you fit in, and you have to trust everybody around you to adopt their own approach to these things, so that societally we grow together rather than we become isolated within society through these Stoic approaches. Fascinating stuff.
So if you're okay, Paul, just before we end, we'd like to ask just a few short, quick-fire round of questions.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll start this off then, Ash. What are your hobbies?
So gardening. I became a lockdown gardener during the pandemic. Up until that point, I'd had no interest in gardening. My father has been a lifelong gardener, especially vegetable. My grandfather before him fed my dad and my dad's five siblings out of his garden for much of their life at home. So it was always a great source of disappointment to my father when I had no interest at all in gardening. Pandemic came along, I went and did a course with the Royal Horticultural Society, took up gardening, and have not looked back since, and have one of the great benefits now is I have so much more to talk with my father about.
And we just spoke about lifelong learning as well, and that's the new thing you've picked up in your adulthood.
Yes, I've been on it for a long time, always been on various courses and one thing or another. Currently studying with the Oxford Continuing Education Department in creative writing, which I'm thoroughly enjoying. That's one of those things we were talking earlier on about how you learn something new, and it's not just the new thing, but it's how it recalibrates how you think about lots of other things. It's creative writing course series that I've been on for about a year or so now, and I've got a bit more to do yet. That's having such a wide impact on me, in just the way I'm thinking about things, the way I'm observing things, how I read books differently, how I read my own writing, be it essays or stories or just simply emails. I'm so much more careful and cautious and positively critical of the written word and its implications. Fascinating stuff.
Nice. If you could invent a new type of technology, what would it be?
What would I invent? Well, I would approach this by thinking, what are the limits on our lives at the moment? So I got to this point in thinking this one through. The limit on our lives is that we need oxygen. So I want to invent something that takes away the need for us to rely on oxygen. If we can do that, then we can go and live on lots of other different planets and don't have to worry about what we're doing to this one, or we can leave this one to recover. Also, I believe that much of the aging that goes on is a result of us oxidizing. And so if we don't need oxygen, maybe we're not going to age quite so fast and quite so much. So yeah, I'm going to invent an adaptation to the human anatomy that takes away the reliance on oxygen.
Changing years of evolution.
Yes.
Quite the feat.
Yes, I don't fancy handling the patent application for that one.
Next one. If you could have dinner with any celebrity / influential figure, past or present, who would it be?
Gosh, just one?
We'll give you four.
Oh, okay. All right. I'd love to sit with Winston Churchill. More importantly, I'd love to sit with Winston Churchill over a bottle of Paul Roger champagne, which was his favourite tipple, I understand, and just observe his wit when he's drunk. Because I think some of the best stories about Winston Churchill are this sharpness of his wit, this speed of his wit when he'd had a few drinks after dinner. So I'd love to get drunk with Winston Churchill. That would be great. I'd love to sit with the King, King Charles III. And I'd like to ask him whether, in fact, the Crown is real. How far did Netflix get in making this up versus what really happened? I think that would be quite a cool thing.
Kind of like fact or fiction, isn't it? In terms of where that line is being drawn.
Yeah, absolutely. Margaret Thatcher. I'd love to take some time with Margaret Thatcher. Thatcher was Prime Minister when I started out in business. She was my view of her was that she was up front of this steam train, stoking coal in that engine and driving our country along. Her free market principles, deregulation, privatization, reducing government, getting red tape out the way of business, stimulating investment, suppressing union controls, getting inflation under control. A lot of this kind of resonates with where we are here in March of 2023, that we've got these sort of problems again. But she was so, not everybody's cup of tea, Thatcherite politics, extremely controversial still to this day. But she enabled me to do what I did in those early days. And I'd love to talk to her about what she thinks is going on today in government, in the country, on the world stage, and what would she do if she were back in power again? And, what would be the 21st century Thatcherite approach to the problems that we've got? That would be fascinating. I've got one other. Matt Pritchett, the cartoonist in The Telegraph. This man has got such a wicked interpretation of current affairs in his simple characterizations of his cartoons. I'd love for him to just be sat in the corner with pen and paper while I'm talking with all these other people and just sketching all the things that are said into these fabulously funny images that he creates.
So I guess the last one that I have is, what tool or tools are indispensable for you?
My answer probably is none. In terms of tools, I can't think of anything that I use. Maybe in the garden without a spade, life might be a bit difficult. But, you know, if this is a business-related question, what I would say is a habit. There's one habit that I couldn't live without, and that's the habit of time to think. I think this is so important. We lose the ability to do this with the rate and pace of life and work and everything else that we have to put up with these days. Just to stop and think and reflect back on what's happened and put it in the right context, store things away, explore what they really mean to me. And then to look forward, to plan, to imagine things, to look at different outcomes, shift my paradigm around things, move my context, my point of view on stuff. I couldn't do without the habit of having time in my diary to just shut my eyes and think stuff through.
I guess it's sort of like spring cleaning your mind.
Yeah.
Just like dusting things off and then just feeling more like calmer, and you might feel more settled. Because as you said, I completely agree with this. In a world that is so busy, the simplest thing of just, you know, even just standing still or sitting still, people just forget. And yeah. It's like, I don't have time for it. But it could easily just be as simple as pulling up a chair, sitting down, breathing, or taking a few deep breaths for a few seconds. Yeah. That's it. But yeah, it's almost like that's just been skimmed over.
That's right. Yeah. And your spring cleaning analogy is a good one, in that what I tend to find is that not only does everything get put back in its place, I'm a great believer in resetting. So when I've done something, I like to reset, you know, even if that's cooking a souffle. I won't leave the kitchen until everything's washed up. It's all back in the cupboards. All the ingredients have been noted as to I need some more flour, I need some more this, that, or the other. So I've reset. So I'm ready ready to go again. I don't leave anything hanging. And I think thinking enables me to reset everything that I've done in a period of time. But what also it does with the spring cleaning analogy is you find something tucked down the back of the sofa as you're spring cleaning that you forgot about that's actually really quite interesting or now pertinent. You know, it wasn't interesting or pertinent to something when I thought about it first time, but I've now been able to drag it back out of some deep, dark corner of my mind, and it actually relates to something, and I can stitch it together, and things are better as a result of me bringing forward stuff that just hangs in the shadowy crevices of my mind.
So yeah, your mind and your brain are arguably the most important tools that anyone is inherently born with. And back to Ash, your tool analogy of it, you need to sharpen it all the time, the lifelong learning, the curiosity, it all folds into one. So yeah, your mind, your brain, and how you think, how you set time for yourself is definitely the most indispensable tool one can have.
Yeah, I'd like to think the heart is in there, probably about equal measure, and that the heart be allowed at times to influence the head. Oh, but I think you're right overall. Yeah.
Nice. Well, thank you, Paul, for joining our show. It's been great learning, you know, more about lifelong learning, giving back, and just general advice for graduates. But also, I feel like we've learned, you know, a lot through this episode. You know, I'm definitely going to be picking up the 7 Habits by, you know, Stephen Covey, reading that again, and just taking the time out and practicing stillness, I think, and just reflecting, but also knowing that, you know, sometimes if everyone goes through these phases where we may feel unstuck, it's okay. You know, it's not a bad thing. You don't have to be doing everything, you know, all at once, like that film, but like, you know, all the time, even just sitting down, not doing anything. That shouldn't be a bad thing. It's just like, you know, recalibrating, retooling, and just, yeah, prepping yourself up for another day and just trying things out again, and, you know, just resetting. But yeah, so thank you so much. And like I said, yeah, it's been really great not only learning more about you, but having this own discussion about all these, you know, great things. For those that would like to keep up to date with what you do, those would like to get in touch, where can they reach you? For example, LinkedIn, socials, website?
Probably LinkedIn would be the best one, Ash.
Perfect. And to all our listeners who have been tuning in, thank you so much. And we hope to bring you more topics into the fold, as great as this one. And we look forward to, you know, catching up with you soon. Thank you. Take care.
Yeah, so for now, Paul, thank you for your time.
Well, thank you. Well, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you.